All right, the first matter we have on calendar this morning is Ibarra versus State. Mr. Pichette, are you ready?
As ready as I'll ever be, Your Honor.
Okay, and before we get started, we received a motion to remand this back to the district court. We didn't receive it, I guess it was filed Monday, we received it Tuesday. We're not going to address it today.
I was going to start by apologizing for the lateness of that, which I think we explain in the motion, and I was not planning on arguing it because Mr. Sears has not had an opportunity to respond to it.
Okay, good. And did you want to reserve any time?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes if I could, Your Honor.
All right, very good.
I'll try and keep track. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Michael Pichette. I'm appearing for appellant Robert Ibarra, Jr. in this matter. This is, under any circumstances, a very difficult case. It involves a horribly inflammatory crime committed in a small jurisdiction in Nevada, and it involves a defendant who suffers from a multiples of mental health issues. At the age of 9, his father was building a swing set, and a railroad tie fell on Mr. Ibarra's head. And that has had long-term, in our view, long-term effect on his ability to function. He has been diagnosed previously to our participation in the case with brain damage, with paranoid schizophrenia, with concussive disorder. And although many doctors who have examined him have come to differing conclusions, it seems to be a consensus that there is something seriously wrong with Mr. Ibarra. In the course of the litigation, we had Mr. Ibarra tested, among other things, for IQ. And this was prior to Atkins versus State. And his testing came out in what we believed was the mentally retarded range. And we'd like to be clear, and I think it's clear that in the record, that both Dr. Ted Young, who was the state's expert, and our primary expert, the late Dr. Schmidt, agreed that a head injury can induce a condition that is the equivalent of mental retardation. You can satisfy the definition of mental retardation, adaptive deficits plus significantly sub-average intellectual functioning, as a result not just of a genetic or organic disorder, but of a head injury as well. We had an extended hearing in front of the district judge in Ely, in which the main contenders were Dr. Schmidt and Dr. Ted Young. And there was contradictory evidence on a lot of points. Our position is that the district court's resolution of the factual issues in the case is clearly erroneous in several respects, and in particular by the district court's failure to take full account of the problems with Dr. Ted Young's conclusion that Mr. Ibarra was simply malingering and was not because he reached that decision on the testing, that there was no significantly sub-average intellectual functioning, and therefore there was no point in proceeding any further.
Well, wasn't there conflicting evidence as to that very point, and why isn't the judge free to make that determination based upon what was presented to him?
The problem, Your Honor, is that the tests that Dr. Young used and his interpretations of them were not consistent with the professional standards applied to those tests. First, he used an abbreviated short form test, the WASI. I always get confused with these. The WASI is the Wechsler abbreviated scale of intelligence to test for intellectual functioning. That's not a test that is approved as, and the testimony is in the record cited in our briefs, that that is not a test that is designed for a full-scale IQ measurement. He also rejected, and a relied in part on the 1981 IQ test performed by Dr. Gutbride in Reno that came out with an IQ score of 86. We explained at considerable length in the district court what the Flynn effect is. Now, frankly, this is something with which I am not comfortable dealing because this is not an area that I think a layperson understands intuitively. But the Flynn effect is that in an IQ test, over time, it's not that people get smarter, it's somehow people get better at doing the test. So that there can be, between the time the test was administered in 1981 and the time that the test was first normed, that is, it was tested on people to find out where the bell curve of intelligence lies, there could be as much of it as a 15-point inflation of the general IQ scale, so that that 86 would in fact be a 71, which is well within the parameters of the Atkins decision in terms of sub-average, significantly sub-average functioning. The Flynn effect is something that the that Dr. Young was completely unfamiliar with, but volunteered that even if he had been familiar with it, it wouldn't have changed his mind as to the validity of the 86 scale. And the district court essentially disregarded it, but then said, and even if the Flynn effect did exist, it wouldn't amount to as much as we said it would. And then, as we've explained in some detail in the briefing, got the calculation of the numbers wrong. And then there's the problem with the TOM. The TOM is the malingering test, the test of memory malingering. Interestingly enough, developed by a Dr. Tombaugh. And that is a test of effort. It's designed to see whether the individual is putting out an adequate effort in taking the intelligence test. The materials with that test and the materials and the subsequent literature on it explain that that test is not normed for people with retardation or with other psychiatric disorders. So now what we're looking at is something that is difficult. It's difficult for me to understand just as a layperson. But if you look at the testimony, it is difficult for both Dr. Young and Dr. Schmidt to explain how subtle this problem is.
Mr. Buschetta, that leads to my question. Isn't the difficulty that you're discussing compounded by the absence of definitions in the statute that was enacted by the legislature to address Atkins concerning the developmental period, as well as what is the definition for subaverage intelligence standards? Doesn't this court need to address that in this case? And if so, what would you argue would be the appropriate standards to be adopted for those two seemingly fundamental definitional requirements when these assessments are conducted?
Your Honor, I think Atkins does give us some guidance by adopting essentially the AAMR definition of mental retardation. Significantly subaverage is not a totally standardless expression. It's a term of art used in the retardation literature for two standard deviations from the mean, which lands you at 70, an IQ of 70 points. And given the margin of error, basically between 65 and 75, is around where that falls. So I don't know that this court has to pick a specific number. And I think the literature is quite clear that it's undesirable. And I think the legislature thought that it was undesirable because they were presented with some numbers in the course of adopting the statute. Because as soon as you say it's 70, then there's going to be an impulse to say, well, if it's 71, you're just out of luck. Where, in fact, MR can be diagnosed for people whose IQs range all the way up to 80 if the adaptive deficits are present. That's why it has to be considered as a whole, and that's where the adaptive deficits, as well as the difficulties with other mental health problems, such as schizophrenia and such as brain damage, play into the standard. Unfortunately, I don't think this court can really say, all right, you're safe if it's 70, but not safe if it's 72, because that essentially makes a bright line where there is no bright line. The only other case where I've dealt with this that actually reached a decision was at the Pardons Board, where the three doctors appointed by the Pardons Board agreed that despite the fact that some of the testing was over 75, the individual, because of the adaptive deficits and the subaverage intelligence, was definable as retarded. And I think the problem is really, in terms of considering all of these other problems, is one not of definition, but of synthesis. If you have
wouldn't this be necessary, though, in making the calculations under the Flynn effect?
The calculations on the Flynn effect involve historical data. If you have a test in the past or you have a test now and you can compare it between the time the test was normed and the time the test was given, that effect is standard, as I understand it. But the question about how you characterize that previous test, so if we take the 86 IQ and we factor in the Flynn effect and we end up with that IQ test rendering something that's about 71, that's something where a professional, a mental health professional in this area can say, all right, if we take that number as 71 and we look at the adaptive deficits, that can add up to mental retardation. I think really, as much as we would like clear, bright line standards, they just don't exist in this area.
Well, what about the development period? That seems to have been a significant issue to the district court. And several states have enacted specific ages for the development period, with seemingly most setting the age at 18.
And that is the standard, I think, that the AAMR has used. The question is, in an individual case where you have delayed development, can you say this is existing at the developmental period? The problem that we have is very frequently not a question of when the developmental period is. It's a question of having data from whatever we can call the developmental period and what those data mean. Because, for instance, Mr. Ibarra got married at one point. Well, does married mean that he is functioning well and therefore not maladaptive? Or does it mean he can't live by himself and so he has to be with somebody who is taking care of him? And, of course, on his divorce, he attempted suicide, or at least some form of self-mutilation, which was quite maladaptive. So I think the problem is we are disproportionately, and I don't think we can get away from it, dependent on the opinions of experts in this area. And that's why when we get, for instance, to the third point I was going to make about Dr. Young's testing, the TOM is not supposed to be used is not normed for people with other disorders. And he administered the TOM in a setting that was not contemplated by the test, that is, with guards in the room. And Dr. Young's response to that was, Mr. Ibarra is around guards all the time. Well, Mr. Ibarra is a paranoid schizophrenic who is housed in a prison in the county where this highly inflammatory offense occurred and where everyone hates him. To say that is not a material problem with the results of Dr. Young's testing ignores the context, and this is all about context. And on that point, let me just finish with the fact, which I think is somewhat relevant given the approaching election on question two. Here we have a trier of fact who has lived in this community, the smallest, one of the smallest communities in Nevada, where the tenure of his office is, I submit, entirely dependent on not giving Robert Ybarra relief. I think that is a compelling problem, and I think that's why this court needs to address the disqualification issue in this case as well. If I can save what few seconds I have left.
You know what? We had a few questions for you, so I'm going to go ahead and give you 3 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Sears.
I have to begin by saying that the state of Nevada's view of Mr. Ybarra's intelligence level and his state of insanity have no congruence whatsoever with what was represented by Mr. Pichetta. One of the concerns with this case is we've been told that lay people, that's us, everyone in this room, mistakes normal functioning in some areas for the absence of mental retardation. That's what Mr. Pichetta said in his brief. The problem that that creates then is if lay people cannot identify mental retardation, we are left with the opinions of experts. And that's what this case, oddly enough, came down to. Mental retardation, according to the Supreme Court, was designed to catch the lowest 2% of society, the lowest functioning. Sixth grade was the highest level of education, intellectual functioning achieved. At least that was the testimony that we heard in the Pierce from Atkins. In this case, there were a lot of experts. There was Schmidt and Mitch Young at the hearing on behalf of Mr. Pichetta's client, Ybarra, versus Dr. Ted Young, okay, and then 3,000 pages of information that came from more than 12 doctors who over 30 years treated Ybarra. And so what you see in DeBrescu's order is you see an analysis not just of the testimony that he heard from the folks that were in front of him, but an analysis of 3,000 pages of work over 30 years by multiple physicians. And what you saw in that analysis is you saw some physicians saying, this guy is low functioning. He's low normal. But if you search that 3,000 pages, what you don't see and what was asked for in this court is you don't see a finding by anybody until after 2000 that Ybarra was mentally retarded. Now that's interesting, and I think it's interesting because the statute says has significant sub-average intellectual functioning. It doesn't say 70 IQ or 60 IQ or 80 IQ. The statute does give us some kind of a standard. And the Atkins standard is he's mentally retarded. If, in fact, he was mentally retarded during the developmental period, when you look at the 3,000 pages of this guy's history, you would think that you would see one doctor say during that period of time, he's mentally retarded, but it's not there. What you see is low functioning, low normal, average intelligence. When you finally do get an analysis by Gutright, he comes out and says he's 86 in one area and 90 in another. Nowhere does he place him anywhere in the 70s. Nowhere does he say he's mentally retarded. That is the only test that DeBrescu had to rely on that's remotely close to the developmental period, because that was done in 81 when he was conceivably 26, 27. And of course, Mr. Ybarra doesn't like that test. And so there was a lot of talk about how that test has been invalidated. And yet, when you look at all the other doctors that examined it, you're still not seeing anywhere in the record until after 2000 the word mentally retarded. The other part of this that is, I think, difficult is that because of the uniqueness of this case, in other words, you don't have any records of mental testing when he's in school. And I don't know why it's not here, but it isn't. California schools are pretty well-developed schools, especially in the Sacramento area, the capital of the state. That's a school district with lots of money, and yet there doesn't appear to be any testing. Now, 30 years later, when you do the testing, the problem is pretty simple. What is the reward for doing a good job on the testing? How do we reward you for good work? Of course, we're all accustomed to rewards. We make money. We make all sorts of things for doing good work. What is Ybarra's reward for doing a good job when he takes this test? He gets executed. That's the reward. And that's the problem with testing in 2000, is you've got no reward whatsoever for doing a good job. He doesn't have any chance of getting anything. What's the reward for the experts who come in and testify in this case? It's almost as bad, isn't it? If an expert says, well, I've tested him on behalf of the defense, and guess what? He's low normal. He doesn't even get called for trial. He doesn't earn a fee. There's no reward for anybody to come forward and say, this guy's not mentally retarded on the defense side of this case. And accordingly, you don't see any of that because, quite frankly, well, let's take an example. In 1980, when McGuire was defending this, McGuire spoke to Robin, Ybarra's wife at the time, and said, we'd like you to come testify. When Robin found out the defense was going to be not guilty by reason of insanity, that he was delusional and had hallucinations, Robin said to McGuire, all the time I've known him, he didn't have any delusions. He's never had any hallucinations. He's never acted crazy. So, what do you think? Did McGuire put her on the stand during the trial? Of course not. He buried that information. It would have been malpractice for him to stick her on the stand and directly contradict what he was trying to raise. And that's the problem. The other issue I think that you run into in this unique case is we have an individual who self-reports he began using alcohol and marijuana at about 14, 13. He used those drugs until commission of the crime. Once he got into the prison system, if you review the record, you see a record of a guy who's been getting psychotropic medications for the last 30 years. And how valid can any sort of IQ testing be done on somebody who's been getting that kind of drugging for 30 years? When you combine that with a lack of motive for a good performance, I think it's clear that you're not going to be able to obtain any valid test results at this stage of the proceedings. I think you have to do what DeBrescu did, and that is go back to this period of the 80s and see how he performed. How did he do in school? How did he do on the job? What were his earnings? Was he earning minimum wages? Of course, the answer to all those questions is no, he wasn't. He was a foreman in one instance. He ran a fork truck in another instance. He earned above minimum wage. He was able to get jobs. He stayed employed the entire time until he killed Nancy. Absence of adaptive deficits in the record, if you look at the entire period up until the 80s. Absence of anybody calling him mentally retarded. There was one physician who back in, I think, the 70s said, I may estimate mental retardation, but nobody ever did any testing in the California school district to find out if he had it. The simple fact of the matter is there isn't any evidence of mental retardation during the developmental period. And I would argue whatever you get now isn't going to be very valid because there's simply no reward for doing accurate at this stage. On the contrary, the reward is if you do it accurately, you could get executed. So why Ibarra has no motive to do a good job?
Let me make sure as to what you're saying about, you're saying he's mentally ill and he took the psychotropic drugs?
I'm not saying that.
No, I'm asking you, are you saying that he was mentally ill? Why would they drug him all this years, 30 years, you said? You said he took drugs for 30 years.
He asked for them.
But this is because of mental illness, not because of
Know why he asked for them.
Okay.
I mean, I can't opine for that. We know that he was heavily involved in illicit drugs.
No, I'm talking about the psychotropic drugs that when he was in custody you're talking about.
When he was in custody in the jail, okay, he was not given drugs until he asked for them. McGuire decided to use not guilty by reason of insanity. They said, this guy's not competent to go to trial. He goes to Lakes Crossing for an extended period of time. And by the way, it was while he was at Lakes Crossing for an extended period of time that Gutride did his test, which determined no mental retardation.
Let me ask you, do you deny that he was brain damaged as a kid?
There is expert statements in the record that there's no brain damage.
And what about being a paranoid schizophrenic?
You've got conflicting information in the record about whether he was paranoid schizophrenic. You don't have a clear analysis from any physician that comes out and says he has organic brain damage. I'll tell you how it started. There was a physician early on when he was in school who said he had an organic personality disorder. The next expert that reviewed went from organic personality disorder to organic brain damage, but that didn't happen until after he'd been committed to the crime. So you see this sort of conflation of diagnoses of this guy. And let's face it, in 79, after he has done this horrible crime, what does he say about the crime? He says, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I didn't do it. After being at Lakes Crossing, he finally says, I saw it like it was on a TV set, and I was doing it. And then his explanation was, Satan told me to sacrifice this girl because I'll get my wife and child back. And that was the process of divorce was going on. So his excuse for the crime early on became command voices. Satan told me to do it. And just think of it, in his balance, in his mind, here's the balance that's going on. If I kill this girl, I get gratification how? I get my wife and child back. Now, when he performed that balance, what did he do? He killed the girl. He killed the girl. The evidence seems to indicate he, in fact, lit her on fire while she was either sitting or standing up.
Mr. Sears, that raises the point that is of concern to me in addition to this question, and that is we all know this is an egregious situation, which raises the question about the disqualification of the local judge. I would like to hear you comment on that. I have some grave concerns about that.
Sure. At the time when this case was going on, 81, there were two lawyers doing private practice in Ely, Nevada, Fairman and DeBrescue. Not a huge number. Oddly enough, right now in Ely, Nevada, there's one. Okay? It's not unusual for you to have less than a handful of attorneys doing private practice. Consequently, lawyers in Ely, Nevada wind up doing a wide range of practice. That certainly is the case here. At the point, according to DeBrescue, when he represented these people, obviously the girl was dead. And she had been dead for a while. DeBrescue's job was to prepare two wills, okay? I don't know what the fees were for wills in those days, but it was a very discreet representation. What he prepared their wills, and out they go. No continuing representation on any matters of importance, nothing related to this case.
So no disqualifying interest in your mind?
When you see a disqualifying interest, what do you see? I've got a list here.
What about the appearance?
Financial interests.
What about appearance of impropriety?
Well,
I mean, is that dead in this state?
Appearance of impropriety.
Should I rule on cases of people I represented when I was in Clark County in 1970 when there was only 270,000 people and about 200 attorneys? You want me ruling on my clients?
It would depend on the representation of the client, obviously. That's what the analysis at least appears to be in the records that I review. What was the nature of the representation? Were you in partnership with them? Did you represent them in a business interest? Were you involved year after year? Did you have some attorney disqualification? Were you mad at some lawyer involved in the case? Those are the kinds of things that I see that are violations, qualifying disqualifications. I don't see any of that here. He did two wills. He did an adoption. Excuse me.
I think Mr. Pichetta's point, at least what he expressed, was that this is a small community, and the pressure of this case might have tainted his judgment, and he should have therefore recused from the case. Wouldn't that be the situation in any rural community when you're...
It's not the situation in any rural community. It's the situation everywhere. All of us, prosecutors, judges, justices, we all get exposed to tremendous pressure from the newspaper, from the radio. Watch O'Reilly once in a while. I mean, those kinds of pressures exist for everyone. They certainly exist for a prosecutor. Does that mean I can't prosecute because of public pressure?
Mr. Pichetta made a point that Judge DeBrusco's, with all great respect to him, entire judicial career may have rested upon the disposition in this case.
Hard to imagine. Let me point out a simple fact for you. In 100 years in White Pine County, there has been one DA who did more than one term. Okay? Now let's look at the judges. Lopez has never been opposed on the bench. Hoyt did 26 years and was opposed once. DeBrescu stood two election cycles and never been opposed. The guys who get the pressure in White Pine County are the DAs, not the judges. I mean, it's just that simple. You don't have that kind of pressure. That is absolutely wrong, and it's not supported by any record whatsoever. He's there as long as he wants to be there. I'm sorry.
Colleagues, any other questions? No? Thank you.
Thank you.
I think it should be a concern, Your Honor, because I don't disagree with Mr. Sears about the historical pattern in Ely and probably in some other rural counties. The question is not whether something automatically happens to you. It's, do you get an opponent? If you get an opponent, do you end up spending your own money? Do you end up spending months on the campaign trail? That gives every judge who sits on a case like this in a small community an interest in not doing something that gets the electorate to put up a candidate to run against him or her. That's something that, in this case, the history of White Pine County has one case like this. Every time there is a story in any paper in Ely, the comments, with some of which we've put into the record of this case, the comments from the public are incendiary. So the question is not, has the judge in this case ever pulled an opponent before? The question is, if he ruled in favor of Mr. Ibarra, and the headline in the Ely Times and the banners for an opponent were, this man let an animal off Nevada's death row, is that something that any judge, the standard is a reasonable person as a judge, would cause a reasonable person as a judge not to hold the balance nice, clear, and true, would that prospect make somebody worried?
Well, couldn't that be said in any case, any controversial case? So do you propose that you get a senior judge in on every single controversial case that pops up? And wouldn't that be nice for the judges to be able to not hear those types of cases?
The problem, Your Honor, is we're talking about fairness. And if that means somebody has to go to Ely for a week, then we should be willing to do that in the interest of due process and impartiality. The underlying problem is the same that was identified in the Declaration of Independence when the framers complained that King George III had appointed judges who were dependent upon him for the tenure of their offices. As long as a judge faces loss of his or her job for making a controversial ruling in a case, we have a problem, which is exacerbated in this case by the relationship with the victim.
Mr. Fischetta, since you raised that point, though, every time a judge makes a ruling, he makes a friend or makes an enemy. So why is this any different?
Because this is just a much more inflammatory case in a much smaller community.
If we throw the fact out that Dubescu had a relationship, if he was still charged with this decision, what you're saying, the fact that he has to run for election in the future, still might affect his outcome. How does that make it any different? Because still, he's going to make a friend or he's going to make an enemy based on his or her decision.
In a normal case, you make a friend and an enemy as a judge in every case. It's a different thing to make an enemy of the entire county. And that is what we're talking about.
Well, even if, as I said, there's no relationship, as you just said, the judge who rules on this case makes a friend or an enemy of the entire county, based on what you're saying.
Yes. And
so there's a no-win proposition for anyone, whether they have, as you're saying, an interest or as the state is saying, no interest.
Unless there is protection for a judge in the tenure of his or her office, I believe that is fundamentally violative of the Due Process Clause. But in this case, there is the additional wrinkle that the particular judge in this case had a relationship with a professional relationship with members of the victim's family. And the headline for that would, I believe, be much worse than even the headline for any other judge. It would be not just judge lets animal off of death row. It would be judge stabs former clients in the back by letting daughter's killer off of death row. And every member of this court has seen the flyers on one side that say, this candidate is the only one endorsed by a police union. This candidate has always been viewed by police as tough on crime. That's just sort of the small change. But in a case like this, where everything about this case is, it's the end of the world in White Pine County.
Mr. Pichetta, this court in 2005 rejected this very same argument in the post-conviction order. In your briefing, you say that you raise it again because you say that in 2005 the court didn't have the disclosure of the prior representation of the victim's family. How does the prior representation of the victim's family reinvoke the due process question because of judicial elections?
It aggravates.
Is there anything in the record to demonstrate that other than this argument?
No, Your Honor. But it's an objective test. It does not require the judge to say, and yes, this and that about this relationship. It's still an objective test. Thank you for your patience.
All right, thank you.